Hello, everybody. Welcome. Welcome to Beyond Awakening, the Future of Spiritual Practice. I'm Terry Patton, and tonight, for those of you in Europe, this morning for us in California, and through across the calendar, depending on where you are, we'll be continuing this deep exploration of how our spirituality can make good on its promise and potential to actually help human beings rise to the challenges of our world crises. And we'll be doing this with psychiatrist, author, and philosopher, and spiritual practitioner, Dr. Roger Walsh. As you probably know, I convened this series to serve the evolution of consciousness and culture by creating a probing and wide-ranging and, I hope, deep public dialogue about how spirituality can play a key role in helping us find the inner resources that can enable human beings to rise to the challenges of our times and manifest a healthy human adaptive response so that we can make this transition to a sustainable human presence on our planet. And we've had a series of profound and edgy and enlivening conversations in which we've focused on many aspects of this question. And this morning, Roger will join me in a dialogue entitled Becoming an Optimal Instrument of Service. What does it really take? Roger Walsh graduated from Australia's Queensland University with degrees in psychology, physiology, neuroscience, and medicine. He's both an MD and a PhD, and then he came to the United States as a Fulbright scholar. He's now at the University of California at Irvine, where he's professor of psychiatry, philosophy, and anthropology, as well as an adjunct professor of religious studies. He is probably one of the most influential voices in integral philosophy, and also Ken Wilber's oldest and best friend. His research and writing span many fields, including enhancing psychological health and well-being, meditation and contemplative practices, the nature of religion and spirituality, and the psychological dimensions of our contemporary social, environmental, and other global crises. He's a deep spiritual practitioner, a researcher, and a teacher for over 3 decades. In fact, today he's just finished up a 2-week meditation retreat period. His books include many really wonderful books. I'd like to point especially to Essential Spirituality, the 7 Central Practices, which has a foreword by the Dalai Lama and is really a central text for many people across the world, really distills what all of our religious traditions have in common. Also a wonderful book called Paths Beyond Ego. Another book more recent, I think his most recent book, The World of Shamanism, which is really quite a deep dive at that. He also, some years back, had a book called Staying Alive, the Psychology, I think it's something like the Psychology of Human Survival, which we'll kind of talk about that topic, and quite a few articles on that topic we'll get into a little later. But Roger's a three-dimensional human being. In other lives, he was a circus acrobat, a record holder in high diving and trampolining. And recently, he actually graduated from the San Francisco Comedy College and tried his hand, as he commented, he says, rather unsuccessfully at stand-up comedy. He's married to noted psychologist Frances Vaughn, and together they have co-authored several books. Among the many things I love about Roger, aside from his obvious intelligence and insight and erudition, is his clear-eyed insight into the nature of ego and mind and his sincere humility and dedication to serious practice. I'm just delighted to welcome you, Roger, as my guest today.
Well, thank you very much, Terry. That's a very generous introduction, and thank you for the privilege of having this dialogue with you and with our listeners.
Yeah, great. Well, I wanted to kind of refer back to I was looking over some of the articles you've written over the years. I think it went back in terms of the things that I saw just looking at your website to an article you wrote in 1985 on the psychology of human survival. And so you've been thinking pretty deeply and writing and exploring this whole topic of this world crisis, human survival issues, the psychology of sustainability, and you've reapproached this topic again and again from quite a number of different perspectives. And having worked it through, you know, from one angle and then another and then another, what stands forth to you right now as the most important or vivid or relevant? Where would you begin?
Well, I think perhaps, Terry, the thing that pops to mind immediately is just the sheer complexity of the issues we're dealing with. There are many dimensions, facets, the many levels on which they are expressing themselves and which we need to respond. You've mentioned the thrust of this series you're hosting as looking at the spiritual or inner life contributions to our global crises and concerns, and that's certainly one major dimension that I think one major concern that both of us share, and presumably a lot of our listeners too. So I don't have a simple answer to what stands out, but I think that lack of simplicity is an expression of the very nature of the issues we're facing. Their sheer complexity, their enormity, the scale, and of course their complexity and depth.
Yeah, I mean, I think in the face of that, an awful lot of us tend to feel a certain amount of overwhelm, and in feeling overwhelmed by the complexity, a sense of hopelessness and impotence easily arises, and that's not so adaptive. How do you work with complexity that we can't completely penetrate in a more creative way, do you think?
Well, I think there are many ways that we need to approach this in order, as you say, not to feel overwhelmed. And they range across choices we make about what to focus on, where to put our efforts, through to another extreme, a way of approaching the global issues and the work we do as a spiritual practice. For example, and this is probably something we'll get into, working on social global issues as a form of karma yoga, that is a spiritual practice in which a central part of the very work is a letting go to our attachments, for example, to our specific egoic outcomes, etc., etc., and also working with the opening to mystery that the other side of course, this sense of overwhelm is from a more positive perspective. This is part of the incomprehensible mystery of life. We can't comprehend life itself, let alone, and we certainly can't comprehend in their full complexity many of these issues. And that can either result in a sense of egoic overwhelm, or it can result in a willingness to let go of the egoic need to fully comprehend and open to mystery.
Mm. And in contemplating this as deeply as you can, what are your sources of greatest optimism? I think that as people look at the crises, it's relatively easy to come up with reasons for concern and pessimism, and often people feel more challenged to feel optimistic, and often, you know, really finding our way into a really vital engagement with this depends on our having some sense of hope.
Yes. So what are the sources of some of that that hope? Well, let's look at two angles. One, of course, is that yes, we can need and use sources of hope as inspiration. At a still deeper level, of course, we attempt if we're doing this at a very deep spiritual level, to let go both hope and fear, recognizing those are symptoms of our particular attachments. But that, of course, is a very deep level, which maybe we'll get into more. So in the immediate question of what are the sources of hope, I think there are many, perhaps best summarized by something Ken Wilber, who you mentioned at the beginning, once said to me in a conversation we were having about these global issues. He said, "You'll never underestimate the power and creativity of the human spirit." And the positive side of our global challenges, of which there are several, is first that these are calling forth appropriate and skillful responses from growing numbers of people. Second, that these problems we face, the global problematique, is by its very nature larger than any individual or group or even nation state, and call for a collective response that hopefully will supersede many of the boundaries that have set the limits and created so many of the conflicts we've faced in the past. So those are some of the things which, you know, which come to mind as sources of hope. And also there's also the sense of that involvement activity itself creates hope. There's research evidence showing that people who take even some small steps to contribute to problems and issues, be they large or small, tend to feel, as a result, more hopeful than those who don't.
Right. Yes. Yeah. One of the shifts of perspective that has felt most important to me as I contemplate these things is under certain circumstances, various public discussions, writings, conversations, and I know I even slip into this often enough, seem to take place as if I'm in the stands watching the action on the field, and I'm kind of, you know, handicapping the horse race. Is consciousness and cooperation and communication going to win, or is this kind of unsustainable slow motion train wreck, you know, catastrophe going to kind of prevail here?
And
when you get
very, sorry,
I'm
go
sorry.
Ahead. Well, I was just going to say that's a really crucial. I mean, you've just nailed the question. We're in a race between consciousness and catastrophe, and you've just nailed the essence of the issue. I mean, usually these issues are thought of as in military, political, or economic terms. And the missing dimension has been the inner one you've mentioned and you just focused on. So you just want to emphasize that you've nailed the missing dimension there.
Yes, absolutely. Well, even though seeing that, I can sometimes look at it as if I'm in the stands and I'm not on the field. And as I have become much more active and engaged and really begun to live my mission to try to make a difference, I feel more clearly more of the time as if I'm on the field and in some real sense have the ball, and my own optimism has certainly surged as I've had that sense of engagement, just as you were describing. You know, this is something, there's research evidence that anyone feels of finding our way to make contributions, even if they're small, you know, because we're dealing with enormous challenges on an evolutionary scale. Still, if we can engage and do our little bit, then I think we do feel we inherit some sense of connection to that, the vital evolutionary rising sap that is the juice of a healthy adaptive response.
Yes, and I want to zero in on something you said there, Terry, because you raised a number of important points there, but I just want to zero in on one so we don't make sure it doesn't get lost, and that is the question that emerges for anyone who reflects on the state of the world or the state of society, and that's the question, what can I do? And it seems really important to recognize that's a very specific kind of question. Usually, and unfortunately, most people don't realize what kind of question it is. And an need to give a little background here. It's really important to distinguish between factual questions and wisdom questions. Factual questions have a one-time answer. Is it raining outside? Nope. End of question. But wisdom questions are more like koans. Each time you ask them, they have the potential for taking you deeper into yourself, deeper into the question, deeper into the issue, and deeper into the face of reality, hopefully calling forth over time not just a response, but successively deeper levels of understanding and more skillful and appropriate and nuanced responses. And it's really crucial to recognize that the question, what can I do, is a wisdom question, because most people, when they wake up to the enormity of our social issues or want to make a contribution, think they should know, and then feel there's something wrong because they don't know. And yet it's really important to recognize this is a lifetime koan for all of us. It's really something that anyone who has deep spiritual concerns, deep social, global concerns, humanitarian concerns, is going to be looking at for the rest of their lives.
Right. Right. And having to look at in a very engaged way. I mean, one of the wonderful things about that metaphor, and I use it a lot myself, this koan, is that koan practice is effective in the life of a Rinzai monk, because he's sworn he's taken a vow in which his whole life, it's not just his word, it's his career, it's his deepest aspiration. It's all, everything is wrapped up in his engagement with his practice, and he's given an impossible question. He can't move forward until he cracks the code, and he works up his best answer. He comes to the abbot, and he's told, "No, go back." And you kind of have to live in the gap of this impossible question, and it stretches him. Having to face that, having to work with that, and sustain it over time transforms the being. And this, at this moment in human history, because of the knowledge and awareness that we have of the larger patterns, because we've inherited so much privilege and luxury to stand in a relationship to these patterns where we can see so much of it, and because we live at this time in which this crossroads of consciousness and catastrophe is crossing in our own lifetimes, we have been given a koan by the great teacher, capital L, life, that we simply have to find an answer to collectively. But each one of us who's conscious can't ignore it. And if we let this work us, it is a big piece of how we will transform and how evolution will manifest its creative emergent capacities, and to feel that it calls on me to be part of how that manifests is profound and inspiring, and it really drives me beyond the numbness or the superficiality or the distractibility, so that I'm arrested by the aliveness and the poignant vulnerability of everything I love and care about right here, right now.
Beautiful. Yes. So one of the key dimensions here you're pointing to is the fact that done with appropriate intention and attention, then social engagement becomes a spiritual practice. And that's a very different approach to the way, you know, 99% of the work on these issues is being done, understandably. So just want to kind of put a name on what you're saying. You're saying that this becomes an existential confrontation and has the potential for being a transformative spiritual practice.
Yeah, that's it. And I think that this whole series is founded in my intuition that that many of us who have been longtime spiritual practitioners have some sense that our practice does have to express itself in some kind of activism and larger service. but that many of us haven't found a way to realize that as fully as is obviously called for. And it seems that if large numbers of us do, the character and spirit and energy of many nonprofit organizations that are pursuing activist agendas and the whole energy of their influence and the whole dynamic of their capacity to produce positive change could really shift. That there is a potential practical outcome of a different level of spiritual inspiration motivating and shaping the quality of participation of many socially responsible activist efforts.
Well, hopefully so. And this has been an ongoing edge between some socially engaged individuals and organizations and some spiritually engaged individuals and organizations for some time. And we're still seeing how that plays out at the institutional and larger level. But certainly, you made a point there that I just want to draw out and give a name to. You said that a number of people who've done spiritual work feel a calling to contribute, and this is certainly so, and part of a larger pattern which has been recognized throughout history. The great historian Arnold Toynbee pointed out that the people who made most contribution to civilization throughout history exhibited a pattern of what he called withdrawal and return. That is, they tended as individuals and looked at historically and over the bigger picture. These people who really had made the most profound and lasting contributions tended to exhibit this pattern of withdrawal and return. They tended to take some time to withdraw from active social engagement and life, to turn attention inward, to wrestle with the great questions of existence, and usually through some sort of spiritual discipline or practice, solitude, prayer, contemplation, etc. And when they had some resolution, some sort of inside understanding, then they felt drawn back into the world to once again engage and contribute and offer what they'd learned, usually in the form of help, healing, or teaching.
Yeah. Well, I know that the people who are listening to our conversation are all caring, sincere people who are even engaging this conversation for the very same motives we are. And they're not just trying to understand sort of the wisest answer that that you or some other wise individual, has to these. They're trying to answer them in very specific and real personal terms. And I wonder what you've noticed about the ways that sincere people engage these questions, that where you might address this. Clearly there's probably a unique answer for each individual to some degree, but there probably are principles or even ways to approach the question that might be deeper or more likely to be fruitful. There might be dead ends that ought to be avoided, ways of framing it that are not terribly skillful. What would you first want to say to someone who's really trying to crunch this koan in a very real and personal fashion?
Yeah. Well, that's a great question. It's really the question, or one of the questions that so many of us are facing. As I've looked at people who feel this call to contribute and engage, I notice a number of patterns and a number of wonderful things and also some traps that people can fall into. First, I think it's really important to recognize that this is a process, engaging this koan of how can I contribute is a process. And unfortunately, one of the traps people fall into is they don't recognize it's a process. People wake up to the urgency of our situation or some injustice or some tragedy or some suffering, a form of suffering, and want to help and often immediately come in with a judgment, I should know what to do, and yet that's not necessarily so, as we've just been talking about. So first off, to recognize this is a process and to find a skillful adaptive response can take time. You mentioned my own book, Staying Alive, Psychology of Human Survival. You know, when I first woke up to the threats we were facing, I wrestled for a long time. It took me at least a couple of years before I recognized, you know, a specific contribution I could make to zero on, in on the psychological side of these issues. So one trap is judgment for not knowing what to do, and the antidote is the recognition this is a process and it requires some patience, and we're in this for the long term. Another is as you said, just to amplify your point, Terry, that each of us has a unique answer to this, and the question becomes, okay, given my unique circumstances, my knowledge, skills, network, contacts, information, what's the contribution that I can make? And so that brings in the unique aspect of this. Another is, again, I'm picking up on points you've made, is that each of us is merely human, and each of us can only do so much. And it's very easy to get feel we should be doing great things, and of course we look to do as much as we can, but the reality is each of us can only do so much, and so we need to acknowledge our humanity, our existential limits, and settle for what we can realistically do as opposed to what we might like in a magical world to be able to do. So that's another thing. And then there's a still deeper question to be asked. Most people who approach this coming out of spiritual practice ask, what can I do? But there's an even deeper koan, and the deeper koan is, what's the most strategic thing I can do? What's the most strategic contribution I can make? How can I, with my particular talents, information, etc., make the most strategic contribution? And I like to think of, there's a nice metaphor for this called trim tabbing. And if you look at a big jet plane, say a 747, it has a huge 2-3-story rudder on the back of that thing. And the air pressure on that flying at 500 miles an hour, there's no way you can turn that by mechanical forces. But if you notice, the rudder has a little rudder in the middle of it. And the little rudder is called a trim tab. And so what the pilot does is he turns this little trim tab one way, the rudder turns the opposite way, and then the whole plane turns. And so trim tabbing is a nice metaphor for applying influence at the optimal place. And so each of us, anyone who's really interested and concerned with making a contribution, is looking for their trim tab. Where can I stand? What can I do that will have most impact for least effort? So those are some of the ideas that come to mind in response to your question.
Well, those are really essential and beautiful points. I really appreciate that. And it sounds really like we are beginning to get next to our stated topic for our conversation, how to be an optimal instrument of service, what really works. I know that you work with this question not only in terms of global issues, but very, you know, humanly and locally. Service is not only about these big survival issues, although they're very, very important. If we're somehow not a presence of service in more immediate ways to the people and situations that we interact with every day, our larger impact is certainly not going to be as positive as it could be. How would you want to frame, you know, the essential aspects of that question and how it can be most effectively and powerfully answered?
Well, the question you're asking here, how can I become an optimal instrument of service? Again, I think for me, what I would want to emphasize is the context to hold this is that, again, this is a lifelong koan. And it's something that any of us, all of us who are concerned with spiritual life, with contribution, will be wrestling with once again for the rest of our lives. And it's not only an ongoing question and a koan, it's a moment-by-moment question. And it's a question. So that's the kind of context I'd want to put it in. First, in the big picture of this is a lifelong question for all of us. Second, at the other extreme, I'd want to bring it into a moment-by-moment context and suggest that this question or koan becomes or invites us into a spiritual practice of awareness, sensitivity, moment by moment by moment, because in order to make an optimal response, say, in a conversation, you have to be present. The saying goes, you have to be present to win. And you have to be, we're called to be as sensitive as we possibly can, both to what's being said, the feeling, emotional state, and needs of the person we're with, our own emotional, somatic, etc. responses. And out of that moment-by-moment openness and sensitivity to our experience, we are then open to feeling and responding with the intuitive wisdom that all of us have available to us. So in answer to your question, I'd want to suggest that context of both that this question is lifelong koan and a moment by moment practice to me feels like a really valuable frame to hold it in.
Yeah, for sure. You're one of the, you know, as I said in the introduction, you're one of the things that I really appreciate and respect about you, Roger, is how seriously you engage your own practice. And, you know, this is the fact that you're just fresh off of a two-week retreat, and you've taken a number of other retreats recently, too, you know, really expresses that. So you ask these questions about how to be an optimal instrument of service in the context of being a pretty serious practitioner. And I'm sure some of your choices about how you practice are answers to this question about service. And yet sometimes I know for me, I feel as though there's something I can do that looks outwardly like service, and then something else that I do that seems like it's about my own sanity and serenity and personal balance or health, you know, self-care kinds of aspects of practice that sometimes seem like they, at least on the surface, are in tension with what I might do outwardly. You know, do I serve outwardly and be a bit more stressed out, or do I do something like a retreat that really richly rebalances my own being? So how are you framing these questions about practice and value, and when, especially when there seem to be tensions between self-care and service?
Well, I noticed that I'm wanting to respond once again with the suggestion that this is an ongoing koan, and I think so I'm intrigued that response is coming up multiple times in our conversation. I think it reflects the depth of the questions you're inviting us to consider here, Terry, because these are not the factual questions. These are wisdom questions you're inviting us to explore. So they are in some way koans. And what you're now pointing to is the koan of the question of balance. That is, how do we balance the inner life or inner work, inner practice, with outer expression and contribution? And so a couple of principles come to mind. One is the answer is unique for each of us, as you suggested earlier about another issue. And second, another point, I seem to be echoing or amplifying points you've made throughout this. Another point is that each of us is called to feel into what is the most appropriate answer for ourselves. We can only draw to a limited extent on the advice and recommendations of other people. So those are two key principles. Another key principle, and this gets back to your question about optimal contribution, and I mentioned there are various traps that people can fall into. And one of the traps is burnout. And having worked with people in various doing good works of various kinds, that one of the risks I see is that people can come to neglect their own needs, feeling that the needs are so great in the outer world that they just have to let go of their own needs. And that can be true at times, but it's also true that it's really important to remember that we're in this for the long run, and that we're hopefully going to be working on these issues and contributing for the rest of our lives, and we're going to be most effective in the long run if we look after ourselves and make ourselves more effective instruments of service through our own inner spiritual work. So that's another consideration that needs to be kept in mind. And then I think it really is important to remember that these practices really can make us more effective. And there's lots of research evidence for that. For example, lots of studies on meditation showing that people who have a meditation practice and do it regularly tend to be more empathic and more concerned and more interpersonally sensitive, et cetera, et cetera. So I think there's a lot of reasons to make sure we keep a balance between our work and outer activity, and to keep listening as sensitively as we possibly can to what the optimal balance is, and also to remember not only are there individual differences, but what's appropriate changes at different times for us. So sometimes it's very appropriate to spend ourselves in outer activity, and other times it's really important to take some time for rejuvenation and spiritualization.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, let me ask you about something that I found myself thinking about when we had our opportunity to have a little drive together, and we were chatting, and I was reflecting a little later about a few things. Also, one of our recent phone conversations, you made it clear in a couple of different ways how strongly you really do not want to express your own communications and messages in ways that are grandiose. That a kind of balanced humility is, feels entirely appropriate, and there can be a tendency toward grandiosity that you certainly don't want to fall into or let yourself get drawn into, And I found myself reflecting later on how there were some tensions inherent in the kind of question that I'm asking in this series, which is a big question, in the evolutionary framing of our current crisis, which for very real and rational reasons, we are facing issues in our own lifetimes that seem like they show up on the scope of this enormous process, this life process of human cultural evolution, but because of the impacts of human culture now on the whole biosphere, this could be seen as having some significance even in the scale of all biological evolution on this planet. And perhaps if we interpret the whole evolutionary process as being one in which this evolutionary process has been moving inexorably toward more and more complexity and consciousness and connectedness, it's been trying to see itself and know itself and in some sense maybe self-realize and is beginning to see itself through us, so that perhaps this crisis has significance even on the scale of cosmic evolution. Now, all of that sounds pretty grandiose, and yet a certain amount of it seems common sense real to me. And this sense of the bigness and the potential significance of our impacts often feels inspiring to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I speak about it to others, and they feel inspired at times. And I don't want to be a cheerleader for grandiosity. And yet I think that we fail to feel the full moment of our own responsibility without noticing some of these framings. And but I just wanted to ask you how you sort that through for yourself, you know, confronting all of this as I'm laying it out.
Mm-hmm. Well, a couple of things come to mind, Terry. One is, I think it's important to draw a distinction between grandeur and grandiosity. And grandiosity is an ego inflation. Grandeur is both nature, it speaks to or expresses both the nature of reality and our true nature. So there's an appropriateness to acknowledging the grandeur of the possibilities available to us and the inspiration that some of these works can call forth from us. And there's an ongoing challenge to minimize the ego inflation that can result from life, but also from looking at some of these big pictures and trying to see ourselves and our contribution in the best possible way. And again, that's an ongoing part of spiritual practice. And of course, none of us are immune to it. And one beautiful antidote to this issue, or the concern with grandiosity, is when we approach contribution as spiritual practice, and particularly if we do it as karma yoga, then part of karma, there are three, you know, we can break karma, you know, maybe we should just back up and define karma yoga. Of the various yogas in the Hindu tradition, karma yoga is the yoga of work and action in the world, in which one uses one's work and activities as one's spiritual practice. And one can divide this, you know, up in various ways, but in its essence, the practice consists of three elements. One offers one's activity to Brahman or God or the divine or some higher ideal, some trans-egoic ideal. Second, one does the work as impeccably as one possibly can. And third, and here's the knife edge, one attempts to let go attachment to the outcome, which, of course, is no small challenge when dealing with major issues. But it's that third part of attempting to let go attachment to the outcome that cuts away the egocentricity and inflation that can result from attempting to do good works. Of course, none of us are immune, but at least it's a powerful, time-tested, time-honored practice and remedy. And, of course, it's an ongoing challenge for all of us.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that I find myself feeling as I have these conversations sometimes, Roger, is the sense that, you know, I felt very deeply called myself towards some sort of a breakthrough, that this crisis seems to ask for a game changer, some sort of emergent dynamic. And it seems that it has to come somehow in a cultural level. It has to do with the big patterns of human activity. And it seems like that would have to come from our highest wisdom, and it would have to begin with a few people. And therefore, it seemed to me that wise individuals, spiritual practitioners, might be able to have a real role and a significance, and some of that might have to happen through something new, even though the core of spiritual truth and spiritual practice is, you know, it rests on profundities that have been acknowledged and worked with since ancient times, somehow something in the next while, in our lifetimes, might be important to emerge that would enable us to galvanize a different kind of will and collective action. And so I find myself feeling into this and feeling like, gee, does that need to come from a different place in myself? Is my analysis and my heartfelt response and my gut-level feeling, are they still circulating in a neighborhood among a series of options and possibilities that are still kind of the pattern of the past? And is there something that could be called forth by a positive future that wants to emerge that would break out of that pattern and change the game? And I contemplate that as a big part of the koan with which I'm living. And I wonder, sometimes it feels as if I need to not just be reasonable, but be passionate, that I have to let my whole being be transformed by the fire of this, of the ordeal of this intense koan. How are you working with that kind of question? What would you say to me just contemplating this and expressing and exposing my own process as I just have?
Well, first off, I'd say bravo. Thank you very much. Very sincerely, I would. I mean, I think that the way you're wrestling with this is a beautiful example of a way that we're called to in this time. You emphasized the implication that we're called to be creative. And yes, and since you asked, for responding to your, the way you're presenting this personally, I would say, okay, here's a creative response that, and a nice example of a creative response. There hasn't been, in previous generations, a spiritual teleconference. teleconference coordinator on global issues. So, here we are actually engaging in something novel that you've created out of your own spiritual work. And that feels like a nice example of the very creative process you're talking about.
Well, thank you. And yet, something like the cauldron of the soul? Could we make a meta comment about the very process out of which we find the new? Because, having done this now, I feel back in the fire. I have to find the next way I can contribute, right? And not that I'm not continuing to by continuing the series, but the urgency of the larger problem seems to continue to call me, right? And and there's something about that process itself that, especially because so many of us are apparently caught in relatively ordinary lives where we have to show up for work, maybe in corporations that are doing things we don't feel altogether great about in all respects, or other institutions. I mean, anyone really is working in some kind of aspect of a system that has there's a lot of ill health in the larger systems that we are all caught in, and we are, if we're self-honest, part of the problem as well as part of the solution. And how, I'm living a very unsustainable lifestyle. If everyone on the planet, all nearly 7 billion of us, were consuming resources at the rate I am, we'd need many, many more planets than we have. And so there's something about the taking it personally and letting it cook us a little more. I don't know, isn't there something between agitation and serenity, or the yoga of feeling called to break the game open?
Interesting one. Let's see, I pick up a couple couple things in what you're saying. One is the intensity of the urge to contribute, and when we open to the enormity of suffering in the world, And of course, in any time and era, there's an ocean of suffering, an ocean of suffering far more than we can possibly hope to respond to. But when we open to it, yes, there can be this sense of urgency. And one question you're pointing to is how do we open to that? And one question would be, how do we maintain some equanimity in the midst of it? Another question is, how do we let that sense of urgency work on us so as to call forth the most skillful responses? How do we let that urgency work on us so to answer that question of what's the most effective or what's the optimal contribution I can make? And I think you've mentioned a couple of things there, and I just want to draw them out. One is the very process of staying open to a problem or situation is the prerequisite for creative insight and response. So that's the first thing. And I forget who the philosopher was who said this. There's almost no problem that can't be solved if one is willing to sustain attention, give it enough attention. I don't know whether that's true or not, but certainly seems like an element of truth in it. So that seems one part of it. But there's also a it's interesting if we can play with the feeling you're expressing there, Terry. I'd want to ask, well, okay, so what is that actual sense of pressure? I mean, if someone came into my office and we were working therapeutically, or if I was, say, teaching a retreat and someone came in and expressed that sense of pressure, sense of intense urgency, what I'd want to know is, okay, what's that actually feel like? As a general principle, the answers are found by going into one's experience. In this case, the sense of urgency. So I'd ask, what is this sense of urgency? I mean, when you really feel into it, what is it?
Hi, it's Brad, the audio engineer. Apparently we're having some technical difficulties. If you can stand by here, we'll continue the call once we get everything worked out. Thank you. Okay, it's Brad, the audio engineer. Terry will be.
Hi.
Will be on.
Yes, I'm here.
I'm not sure.
I'm not sure what happened there. I'm sorry to. Beth, it's a Freudian avoidance of being confronted. You're asking a great question there, Roger, and I did feel challenged by it.
Well, there was this long silence. I thought I might have overdone it. Okay, glad we just lost communication and not you.
Yes, I'm fine, I think that question deserves a very rich answer. Perhaps I'm not quite all the way to the full richness of it. First of all, I feel a rightness when I serve. And then I feel the not fullness of it. Like, okay, I did this thing that helped in some way. And then it needs more help, you know? And that sense of the need for more is what it is I'm surfacing. Now, maybe you're asking me how I think I experience that both intellectually and emotionally. That is, I see analytically the need for more, and I feel called to care about that gap and to try to bridge it. Does that
beautiful.
Make sense? Is that?
Yeah. Oh yeah, it makes beautiful sense. And first off, just let me acknowledge your gutsiness in being willing to go into it that deeply. And okay, so I'm willing to play. So I want to take this the next step and say that what I'm hearing is there are two elements. One is a sense of inspiration, rightness. Yes, all right. I'm doing something. This feels right. And another is, and then there's something else which has a couple elements. There's, oh, but there's so much more. And that's true. That is a very valuable existential insight and recognition. I want to suggest there's also a trap there, though, which is a very common trap. And that is that there's more, and it's also coupled with an only partly recognized should, that I should be able to fill them all, to meet them all. And I want to suggest that that's an existential impossibility.
Well, thank you. Yes, received. And yet, doesn't the, you know, part of what I see intellectually, you know, part of what the pattern recognition that's behind my caring, it makes me feel that people have to be thrust rather forcefully into that caring. A tremendous kind of ferment and creativity has to be generating positive options even before they're urgent, if they're to have enough time to cook and to reflect real wisdom and to be strategic, as you suggested. So the sense of urgency that I feel feels healthy to me, and I feel...
And I want to suggest that that's why it's so tricky, that sense of urgency has both very appropriate, healthy, idealistic elements, and when coupled with an impossible should, is a guarantee of suffering.
Right.
And you're not alone in this. I mean, this is something I see a lot in very dedicated, idealistic people. The recognition of suffering calls forth this idealistic response and desire to alleviate it. And when coupled with an unrecognized should about I should be able to alleviate it all, it's a guarantee of suffering and burnout down the road.
Yeah. So that holding it with tremendous seriousness, but not with a kind of injunctive stress.
Exactly. It's the difference between desire and addiction.
Yeah.
And the desire to serve and contribute is wonderful and invaluable to us all. The addiction to having some specific effect is a guarantee of suffering and down the road of burnout and probably problems. It'll spill out onto other people too. And it's probably, you know, since I think what you're very gutsily, you know, playing with here and working with, Terry, is such a widespread issue for idealistic people, it might be just worth saying a little bit about the nature of ideals, because what you're expressing is a beautiful ideal of optimal contribution and service. And yet there are skillful and unskillful ways of using ideals. The unskillful way of using ideals, which is the way most people use them, is to say, oh my God, there's this problem. Okay, I should have this effect. I should, you know, be able to do so and so. It's setting up a specific result as the endpoint. A more skillful way of using ideals is more like an arrow or a pointer. That's the direction I want to go on. I want my life to be about service and contribution. That's skillful. The moment it becomes, I should be able to do so-and-so, or I should do such-and-such, they're suffering.
Beautiful. Well, I would like to pursue this more. We have reached the time when question and answers from some of our other listeners are called for, and I feel like although I feel a little torn because we've gotten to a pretty juicy place, I feel that obligation because we've gotten a tremendous number of very rich questions already asked by folks listening on the webcast. If you want to ask a question via phone, we can hear your voice live, and it's always nice to hear another voice on the line. You can raise your hand by pressing *2. And in the meantime here, I want to make sure that you know about Roger's personal website, drrogerwalsh.com. That's drrogerwalsh.com, which is a really excellent personal website. I was spending some time with it, several times across the months, and there's a rich treasure trove of many articles, other resources, audios and videos, so I want to recommend that to everyone. And also, please stay on the line to the end of the call, and I'll tell you a little more about what's going to be coming up with our upcoming guests. The remarkable great freedom teacher, Candace O'Denver, really one of the most fresh, clear, non-dual teachers right now, I think, in the world, will be with us in 2 weeks. Andrew Harvey, Clarion Call for Spiritual Activism, will be speaking with us about the Divine Feminine on Mother's Day, May 12th. And Sharon Salzberg, a wonderful Buddhist meditation teacher, will be with us. Many of you may know her work. She's really one of the founders of the Theravadan tradition in America on May 26th. Later
That's
on,
a
we'll
great
be...
lineup. Can I just interject? That's a great lineup.
Oh, thank you. and also, A.H. Almas, known as Hamid Ali, the founder of the Diamond Heart School, will be with us. So we haven't quite nailed the date down yet. But and then we'll open up the line so that we can hear at least a few of our voices and say goodbye at the end of the call. So let me dive into a few of the questions that we've received here on the via Instant Teleseminar. We've loving regards from Josefina Lorenzo in Patagonia in Argentina. Other questions really from around the world. But let me pick in to, there are two different people, Peter from Mount Shasta and Sarah James from Cobb Mountain in California, two Californians, saying, why no discussion of the massive shift of material wealth to the very few? Until and unless the basic material physical needs are met, the spiritual just seem like a new opiate of the people, you know, to do nothing, meditate, do yoga, feel better, be a part of the in crowd. You know, Maslow explained this 40 years ago, seems like the wealthy are protected by this new spirituality and are afraid to get political and shift wealth from the few to the rest of humanity. And Sarah's phrasing was a little different, but, you know, the kind of calling for redistribution of wealth and that, looking at the kind of, you might say, the more Marxist analysis that there's a material foundation for these issues and maybe our high level elevated way of interpreting all this pulls us away from a kind of more tough minded and more left-wing form of more revolutionary activism. You know, let's really change this game. We've got a lot of impoverished people. What about it?
Well, first off, simply to acknowledge, yes, the reality of the issue, and there's been an increasing inequity in wealth, and not only both nationally in the United States and globally, with increasing inequities between nations as well as within nations, and it's an ongoing issue. As Jesus said, the poor you always have with you. Well, we've certainly managed to maintain the truth of that one. And yes, certainly I think we need to work in all the ways we possibly can, politically, socially, psychologically, collectively, individually, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, to address this issue and handle it as well as we can. This is one example of the enormity of the forces that we're up against. There are just enormous social, economic, institutional, industrial forces at work, which one can certainly apply, as you suggested, Terry, a Marxist analysis to. And yet, I wouldn't want to go along with the idea that spirituality is necessarily an opiate, a la Marxism. I think it's very important to recognize that spiritual practice, first, the way we use it and what we use it for is up to us. It's a choice. So I have a theory, Walsh's theory, as I modestly, or Rogers' rule, as I modestly call it, that anything can be misused for egoic purposes, and certainly spiritual practice is no exception. And yet, on the other hand, there does seem to be an inherent direction to spiritual practice that it does tend to cultivate what are traditionally called the virtues, including compassion and concern for the poor. So I see it as a hope, but I also see it's always possible for us to fall into what's called spiritual materialism and use it as a defense against recognizing the sorrows of the world and being actively engaged. So thank you very much for raising that question.
Wonderful. Yeah, it does seem like a very legitimate and important question, doesn't it? And yet, I wonder if we're at a time where there's going to be a social movement in the United States, particularly, in which this extreme unequal distribution of wealth will have to be addressed, and perhaps there can be. What tends to go on when you have mass movements of any kind is that there's a kind of a race to the bottom, and the dialogue tends to be one of resentment and blame, even if the redistribution that's going on might serve some healthy purposes. I think one of the dilemmas that I feel as an activist is how can I actually bring myself to bear in the larger political dialogues and issues of the day in a way that doesn't end up getting co-opted by the divisive and unhappy motives of a more confused consciousness. How can we actually be a force of wisdom in, you know, perhaps redistribution of wealth is a good idea, but doing it in a kind of angry, resentful, blaming, class warfare kind of way just perpetuates the division rather than really healing the body politic. And
I want to just draw you out on that, Terry, because I think you just pointed very nicely to the distinction between purely social action, perhaps not such skillful social action, and social action done as spiritual practice, because social action done as spiritual practice has a dual motive. It has the motive of alleviating the suffering, the poverty, the disease, the sickness, malnutrition, hunger, etc., while simultaneously attempting to address the underlying psychological, spiritual sources from which so much of that suffering springs. So it's a two-fold, two-level, two-dimensional approach operating simultaneously. And that's what makes it such a potentially valuable contribution and antidote to so much of the malevolence and negativity of the discourse you described, and also is potentially transformative as we attempt to carry it out.
Right, right. Well, you know, this kind of relates in a less direct way. An interesting question that comes to us from Dale Remley in Amsterdam. How can one practice being non-judgmental and still judge the positions that we take, pro or con, in situations?
Okay, well, that's a very important question. Thank you, Dale. Firstly, the first thing we need to recognize is the word judgment gets used in two very distinct contradictory ways. The term judgment gets used as both condemnation, which is a trap, and as discernment, which is the root of wisdom. So what we are called to do is to discern as clearly and deeply and subtly and sensitively as we possibly can, while simultaneously letting go the egoic condemnation and attack, which only fuel resentment and discord.
Yeah, beautiful. Well, there are quite a few questions here. Let me move on to a few more. I'm beginning to think we won't be able to get to all of them, which I hate. But Elizabeth in Milwaukee says, I currently have a spiritually based practice and business that I constantly struggle with getting to really flourish. On one hand, I have a great business sense and seem to innately know how to market and create a client base. When I'm in my head, the business is working fine. On the other hand, when I'm best in my work as service and fully in the heart, feeling nothing but love, charity, and giving. But these two aspects haven't found a common ground. When I'm at my best in my work is when I remove all aspects of the mind and material concerns from my business. When I'm at best in my business is when I'm furthest from my heart and the work. How do I make them merge? I have no issues around earning for spiritual work or having money, so that's not really it. I just can't seem to make my brain and inner being work in harmony. Work and business don't seem to go together, and I know this is preventing me from truly realizing my fullest potential.
Well, I can resonate with that, having lived an awful lot of my life in my head. I think, Elizabeth, you're clearly dealing with a developmental process there. That what you're asking is essentially a question of integration. How do we integrate these two, for many of us, initially quite distinct ways of being? And it is a developmental process. It does take time, but already you're at the first step of it, having recognized that it is an issue, and there is this divorce between these two ways of being. What can be done to facilitate it? Well, first, the ongoing recognition of that tension and the divorce. Second, many kinds of spiritual practice can facilitate that kind of development, including particularly awareness practices, I think can be helpful. It sounds like you have the heart side, so it doesn't feel like it's necessary to emphasize some of the more, say, loving kindness or compassion type practices. You have the intellectual side, so don't necessarily need to emphasize that. It sounds like it's an integration issue, and so awareness is one of the key facilitators of psychological and spiritual integration. So I just encourage you to continue and deepen that kind of work.
Beautiful. Thank you. Dory from Ormond Beach says, regarding karma yoga, could you speak about how a spiritual person working in corporations that are knowingly hurting others, like pharmaceutical companies, helping and hurting simultaneously, what can be their role? I find myself getting kind of judgmental about friends who work and don't really say anything, or or really try to change things. So what would you say about that?
Well, first off, I think it's very important for us to recognize it's very challenging to change other people. And there's a very interesting thing that emerges in contribution service of any kind. Often when people start, feeling a call to service, the question is that comes up for people is, well, how can we make other people different? What can they do? But it's very interesting. The more we inquire into the possibilities of effective contribution and service, the more we come back to the question, what can I do? And so it always seems to, that always seems to be where it ends up. Now, in terms of talking with people skillfully, we're talking here about what the Buddhists would call skillful means. That is, how do we effectively use our talents and capacities most skillfully to alleviate suffering and help most effectively? And part of that is the recognition that when we're talking with people who we see doing unskillful things, it's a challenge to be to find that effective mode of gentleness and suggestion while also attempting not to come on too strongly, not to create reactivity, not to create anger and resentment, which only deepens the problem. It's an ongoing issue of skillful means for all of us.
Absolutely. There are so many rich questions here. I feel kind of humbled. The one that's interesting comes from Tom in Melbourne, who asks, can a self-realized person do service by just radiating without the need to do any other action? Or is this escapism? And Tom's question kind of comes out of a context in which some of the folks that I spoke with, and I think particularly of Ram Dass, who in a very beautiful way, I mean, I have just the most deep appreciation and respect and love for him. Ram Dass was beautiful, but he was more or less saying, just be love. That was his answer to everything in some sense. And mm-hmm. that your presence will then, and this is what Sadhguru Jaggi Vasudev also said. So how do you respond to that? Because there is a kind of truth that's being spoken by those folks, and yet this, I think we're willingly engaging the relative a little more directly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, there are two questions there, Terry. One is Tom's question, can a person with a high degree of realization radiate? And answer, well, we'd have to look at what we mean here. Radiate in some sort of psychic way, I don't know. How would I know? Radiate in terms of transmission when with other people? Certainly. I mean, transmission is clearly something that happens. Your consciousness is catchy, which is one of the reasons we try to work on ourselves. And to be in the presence of someone who's done deep in the spiritual work can be very transformative, quite remarkable. So in that sense, yes, certainly transmission can occur. And then, the issue of, well, say, can we just be love and be effective? Well, certainly in some ways, and there are a couple of principles we need to keep in mind. We're coming back to something we've talked about here before, Terry, is that there's no one answer for everyone. Some people are called, there's a spectrum to which people are called to activity as opposed to contemplation. And presumably both can be valuable. Unless someone's in a cave, they're not entirely in isolation, and they're certainly not without influence on the people they interact with. So yes, Ram Dass says be love, but there are an awful lot of people who read his books and listen to him, and he has an enormous influence. So So it's rarely as pure as it seems. And, you know, I think each of us has to find our own answer here as to what the appropriate balance is. We're coming back to that magic word balance, which actually, the first retreat I attended with Ram Dass, he emphasized one of the important questions is how do we find our balance?
Yes. Well, there you go. So everybody's having to deal with that.
Indeed, yes.
There are a number of really rich questions here. LD in Prescott was kind of touched by this conversation about how letting go of hope and fear is deep level work, and says, I feel it's always helpful to a person at any level of spiritual practice or development to hear truth. Could you expound a little on this ultimate need to let go of hope and fear that is a necessary step on the spiritual path anyway, and how it can be a good stance from which to engage in social action? Let's keep
okay.
deepening.
Yeah. Yeah. So to understand that that suggestion, which is common to a number of spiritual traditions, that we let go hope and fear, it's necessary to recognize that these emotions are a function of our attachment or addiction. That is, we experience hope, not in the sense of inspiration, but hope in the sense of that grasping desire, that almost, that when at its most extreme, that desperate hope that things will turn out the way I want them to. That kind of hope and fear are both expressions of our attachment to a particular outcome. Now, that's normal, understandable, human, etc. And since LD invited us to talk about deep spiritual work, it's also, from a spiritual perspective, a sign of an attachment or addiction that is ultimately unhelpful and can be destructive and create suffering, both oneself and others. So the recommendation is that we condemn hope and fear, but that we recognize them and recognize that they are symptoms of an attachment or addiction that needs to be released. So in other words, the hope and fear now become feedback signals telling us, pointing us to a particular attachment we have and showing us where we're hooked, showing us that we are called as part of our spiritual practice, as part of karma yoga, to recognize that addiction and to work towards releasing it. And what comes out of that is the experience and beneficial quality of equanimity. So that now, instead of being thrown off balance by the hope or fear or both simultaneously, we do our work with an underlying equanimity, which is an expression of the transegoic approach to the work and contribution we're trying to do.
Beautiful. Yeah. You know, Roger, a question arises for me to ask you. You know, I know how eclectic your influences are. It does seem that in recent years you've done an awful lot of Buddhist work, you know, and yet you've been writing more about shamanism, at least publishing more about shamanism relatively recently. Are you finding the Buddhist orientations particularly useful in your own practice? Are you feeling that they are simply a refined expression of something more universal that you identify with as your primary, you know, whatever it is, evolutionary panentheist, you know? What's your credo these days?
Well, I think I aspire to an integral perspective which recognizes the value and validity in multiple traditions. And yes, I have been drawn to some Buddhist meditations over the last few years and found them very valuable. And I also appreciate the the Buddhist psychology and philosophy. There's a great wisdom there. Of course, there's wisdom in each of the psychologies, philosophies of the great traditions. But as Houston Smith said in his wonderful book, The World's Religions, of all the traditions, it is Buddhism which puts its message most psychologically. And we in the West have had a psychology which until very recently was almost devoid of spiritual depths and post-conventional developmental stage analyses, whereas Buddhist psychology has contributed a significant amount of very sensitive analysis of the way the mind works, how it responds to contemplative practices, and some of its higher potential. So, for its psychology, I find it particularly valuable. For some of its practices, I find it very valuable. And I also appreciate that at its best, it can be relatively non-dogmatic. Of course, you know, all traditions have their masters who are non-dogmatic and universal, etc. But so those are some of the reasons I found it particularly valuable.
But you've also drunk deeply from the Course in Miracles, particularly, and certainly from everything. Are you just saying you're finding it relatively useful in your current practice, and you still draw from everything as an integralist? Is that the kind of bottom line?
Yeah. I mean, my wife, to put it in another framework, my wife calls me spiritually promiscuous. So
That's better than other kinds of promiscuity accusations.
It creates less problems. Each of us has our own proclivity and inclinations. I'm just innately curious and intrigued to see the big picture and make use of the fact that, as Ken Wilber says, this is the first time in history we've had all these traditions available, and it's just absolutely fascinating to see the universality, the commonalities, the depth, and to draw from all these traditions and to do what's called common factors analysis, that is, look at the common factors inherent to these different traditions. This is a unique opportunity and an enormous amount of fun.
Yes, and which is what you did so beautifully in Essential Spirituality, particularly, and in Paths Beyond Ego. Lawrence in Victor wants to ask, please consider, our crisis of crises may be by default because those most active for the positive are trapped in worldviews and practices that are ineffective and are unable to change sufficiently. Trying to keep focus on the positive leads them to stop to avoid accepting the depth and severity of the slow motion train wreck and thus spin their wheels in dreaming of transforming global society, or only replacement by an alternative is possible. Such a replacement from the activist's perspective is viewed as fantasy and thus never seriously researched in the complexity and details needed. Spiritual and activist leaders must consider the status quo practice boxes they're still trapped in.
Yeah, amen. For social action and for life, I mean, it seems to me that one of the ongoing challenges of life is to keep recognizing or attempting to recognize one's presuppositions and the limitations of one's worldview, and it's not easy. So I appreciate Lawrence's point, and it's an ongoing challenge for all of us. I would completely agree with his call for that kind of ongoing investigation. And the other point he made about the trap of emphasizing the positive at the expense of acknowledging the reality of the extent and depth and complexity and enormity of the suffering is also a very valid one. Again, it brings us back to balance, that we can fall off either side. We can get focused on the negative and get lost in despair, or we can focus on the positive and ignore some of the reality there. So, again, we come back to this delicate balancing act and the ongoing challenge each of us faces to attempt to see reality as it is. And I keep coming back to the words of Jesus, which is, I think, an extraordinarily profound statement: the truth will set you free.
Hmm. Well, that may be the most beautiful note on which for us to bring this to a resolution. I want to apologize to, Anne in Vermont and Derek in Santa Rosa and Joseph in Paris and Jude in Woodstock and on and on and on, all these wonderful questions that folks have asked from all over the world. I'm sorry we don't have time to get to all of them. But I do want to let everyone know that if you're hearing this, you can and are not already registered for this series, please go to beyondawakeningseries.com. There's also a blog, beyondawakeningseries.com/blog, where you can find out more information. To learn about my own work, please visit integralspiritualpractice.com. You should know that I do offer a course that takes people through the process of establishing a spiritual practice that I think lands them in an integral approach to spiritual practice and to activism. I also want to announce Coaches Rising, Calling All Coaches, Change Agents, and Consultants. The Dynamics of Change is a new free speaker series exploring the core conditions that create lasting and embodied personal growth and transformation. It features some of the world's leading experts in the fields of personal and collective transformation, including Robert Keegan, myself, Terry Patton, Terry O'Fallon, Craig Hamilton, many more. You can take your personal growth and your work in transforming others to the next level by signing up for free at coachesrising.com. And I want to say something about our next dialogue. Candace O'Denver is a truly remarkable and original voice for clarity. She's a fresh and original voice of free awareness who's brought the essential insights of Doug Chen and the world's highest non-dual spiritual traditions into a completely accessible and non-religious, non-spiritual language that's powerfully activating and moving. And I hope you'll join me for that.
Terry, can I just add that I'm a fan of Candace's too. I think her work is just wonderful.
Yes, she's a lovely human being altogether. Yeah, just a clear presence. Thank you. And then I think I mentioned Andrew Harvey on Mother's Day, and then on March 26th, Sharon Salzberg, and of course many more to come. Well, thanks so much for joining Roger and me today. Let's open up the phone lines so that at least some of us, most of us are on the webcast today, fewer on the phones, but let's hear some of our voices and say goodbye to one another. Goodbye, everybody. Do we have the phone lines opened up? Hello?
Goodbye, everybody.
Hello, thank you. Goodbye. Thank you.
Goodbye, everybody.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone.
Aloha.
Wonderful.
How's it going?